Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be talking about the history of the filibuster in the United States Senate, where it comes from, its evolution over time, and how it has shaped our politics. I hope this will be a conversation that will inform your own understanding of the filibuster as issues over this procedural move is likely to be front and center in the news for the months and perhaps even couple years ahead. For this conversation, we are joined by Adam Gentleson. He is the executive director of the Battle Born Collective, which is a legislative strategy group, and he's also former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid, who is both Senate majority and minority leader in the last 20 years. He's the author of the book Kill Switch: The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. He joins us via Zoom. Adam Gentleson, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
These are the kind of conversations I like having the most. The filibuster, it's not found in the Constitution, is it?
No, it's not. And I think people are often surprised to hear that because, you know, if people think of one thing when they think of the Senate, they think of the filibuster. And it does have this sort of storied history. But no, the framers did not include it. It was not included in the original Senate rules. And in fact, they made very clear that they would have opposed it if someone had tried to propose it at the time. The framers were very, very clear that they believed in majority rule. They wanted a system that was full of checks and balances to make sure that the majority didn't make rash decisions and rush to judgment. But that's why they created a bicameral legislature with a House and a Senate and a president who had to sign on to laws and then a judiciary to uphold or evaluate the laws. But they wanted all decision points within that process to be majority rule. They thought it was critically important that this government be capable of processing the public business and passing things in a reasonably timely fashion, even if they wanted some thoughtful consideration. So they made very clear that they wanted decision points to be majority rule. And they were attuned to this because they just had a direct firsthand experience with a failed system in the Articles of Confederation, where, you know, the first draft of American government, where there was a supermajority threshold, you know, more than a majority, for passing most major pieces of legislation in its Congress. And that caused massive paralyzing gridlock that essentially caused the government to fail and nearly, you know, cost them the victory in the Revolutionary War on a number of occasions. So they wanted the Senate to be a thoughtful place, a slow and deliberative place, but they wanted it to be a place where after there'd been a fair amount of debate and thoughtful consideration, the majority could actually vote on whether to pass or fail a bill and the business of the nation could move forward. The filibuster didn't emerge till the middle of the 19th century. Its very name sort of indicates its outsider status. It was derived from a Dutch word describing pirates. There was a lot of piracy during this time. The Anglicization of that Dutch word was freebooter, and they sort of turned it into filibuster. There was piracy off the Gulf Coast. This was a big issue that they were very, very sort of focused on. And so they adopted this term related to piracy to describe the sort of obstructive tactics that were starting to become more frequent during that time. But it was always sort of an outsider thing that came into the Senate and started to disrupt it in ways that many people even at the time thought were damaging to the institution.
Yeah, the original meaning of filibuster is worthy of its own show. These were pirates, as you said, who basically overthrew countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, oftentimes, my understanding, funded by the slave power within the United States itself. But that's a little different topic. They sort of just use that term to adopt that term for this procedural move in the Senate. I want to underscore something you said that I think is very important. And that is, before we had a constitution, in the earliest days of the Republic after the Revolution of 1776, we are governed by the Articles of Confederation. This required a two-thirds vote for almost everything that they were going to vote on. And there was a lot of, the reason they had to have a constitutional convention, because there was a lot of problems with the Articles of Confederation. But this is something that was front and center on their minds at the Constitutional Convention when they came up with the Constitution.
That's right. And there were extensive debates about it. And ironically, in every one of these debates, when the idea of a supermajority threshold was raised, it was roundly debated down by most of the delegates to that convention. Ironically, if there had been a supermajority requirement for the Constitutional Convention itself, it probably would have gridlocked and failed to produce the Constitution. We know this because, you know, during a period over the summer where they were sort of at an impasse over the issue of what the legislature, the Congress, should look like, they nearly broke up over this impasse, but it was saved by what we call the Great Compromise, which or the Connecticut Compromise after Roger Sherman, who was sort of the lead advocate of it. And this is what created both the House and the Senate, and it saved the Constitutional Convention. But it passed at the convention by a single vote. Yeah. So if there had been a requirement for a supermajority at the convention, that vote would have failed and the convention itself might have gridlocked. So it sort of proved the framers' skepticism of supermajority thresholds were, you know, derived from their experience of the Articles of Confederation, but also sort of proved and validated right before their eyes at the convention itself, where the whole thing probably would have failed if a higher threshold had been necessary.
So I think it's fair to say, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the framers did believe that the Senate should be a place for deliberative debate, that there should be enough time to have a good, vigorous, rounded debate on the issues that they were going to take up. But if they never intended for there to be a filibuster in which a single senator could actually stop legislation from moving through, then how do we get to a filibuster?
That's right. So, you know, the framers absolutely were very concerned with minority rights. They wanted to protect the ability of the minority factions to, you know, not be trammeled by the majority. They're specifically concerned that, you know, the populace was going to rise up and take all their stuff. They were very concerned with protecting property rights and those sorts of things. So they wanted the Senate to be a break on that. But they were trying to achieve a delicate balance where the minority was always guaranteed a role in the process and a voice in the process. And so, you know, they would never be just sort of cut out altogether. They would always have an opportunity to have their say and try to persuade the other side to come around to their point of view. But they were very clear that, you know, that should go on for a certain amount of time. I mean, there was a two speech rule in the original Senate rules, basically saying if you can make your case in two speeches, that's, you should be able to make your case in that amount of time. You shouldn't have longer than that. So they were very clear. Thomas Jefferson wrote a manual of congressional procedure in which he said debate should not go on superfluously or tediously. There were many ways that senators were able to bring debate to a close in this early Senate. So they were trying to strike a balance. What's happened today is that balance has gotten tilted completely out of whack, far more to the power of the minority. We got to the filibuster primarily through the innovations of John C. Calhoun, senator from South Carolina and sort of the lead advocate of the slave power in the United States Senate at the time. This was sort of the 1830s and 1840s in the lead up to the Civil War. Calhoun got to the Senate and saw that if the majority were left to its own devices, it was going to abolish slavery through a variety of means, economic, territorial, all sorts of things were sort of, you know, surrounding slavery and leading to its abolition. He needed to increase the power of the minority to block the majority in order to preserve slavery. And so he innovated what we would think of today as the talking filibuster, the Jimmy Stewart style, you know, giving a long speech to try to delay a bill, force the majority to make compromises. But eventually, this tool was only powerful enough to delay things because eventually the speakers had to yield. So all through the 19th century, the filibuster started to emerge because of these innovations by John C. Calhoun. He also innovated the connection to minority rights and started saying that he was pioneering this obstruction in defense of minority rights, a sort of rhetoric that we're very familiar with today. But even so, it was only so powerful. It was only powerful enough to delay, almost never to block. Throughout the entire 19th century, the filibuster only actually defeated a very small handful of bills throughout the course of that 100 years. It wasn't until the 20th century that it started to acquire the power that it has today to actually raise the number of votes it takes to pass a bill and therefore block a lot of bills that are unable to meet that threshold.
We're going to get to the 20th century, I promise. But I do want to spend a little bit of time on John C. Calhoun, because this guy is a really interesting figure in American history. And we were talking before we went on air. You're a former legislative aide. I'm a former journalist, Capitol Hill. And we are talking about this portrait that you find just outside of the Senate chamber. And it's an area where you have portraits of and busts of vice presidents. John C. Calhoun was a vice president. And there's this huge, ominous looking portrait of him hanging just outside of the Senate chamber. Tell me more about John C. Calhoun.
So Calhoun is a fascinating figure, easily one of the most influential figures in all of American history, but is often forgotten because I think a lot of times we don't want to think very hard about how he shaped our institutions, because in many ways he shaped them for the worse. Calhoun is fascinating because he started his career, you know, we think of him as a secessionist, sort of the father of the Confederacy, the father of nullification, which he was the lead progenitor of at the time. But he started his career as a staunch unionist, and he tried to rise to power as a strong advocate of federal power. He tried to steer a lot of federal spending towards the South for military bases and things like that. But that he hit a dead end. He sort of hit a succession of dead ends, first in the Adams administration, where he ran for president but was elected vice president. Adams gained power through what was called the corrupt bargain, where he didn't win an electoral college majority. It went to the House of Representatives, and Henry Clay, who was Calhoun's sort of emerging nemesis, swung his block of votes to Adams to give him the presidency. And this was called the corrupt bargain. Calhoun was very upset about this. But he was also Adams' vice president, which was a little awkward. And so he had this falling out with Adams. He then went over to Andrew Jackson and became a big Jackson supporter. He then had a falling out with Andrew Jackson over what we call the Petticoat Affair, a fascinating episode in American history where Calhoun's wife snubbed the wife of another cabinet member who was known to be, what they would say at the time, a woman of loose morals. This created a massive controversy that caused the president to have to intervene and side with the other cabinet member against Calhoun. This was the biggest story at the time. And so that got Calhoun cast out of Jackson's inner circle. And so it was after these dead ends that he sort of reverted to sectionalism and secession and nullification as his path to power. So the Calhoun as the nullifier that we think of wasn't how he started his career, and it took some time to get there. But once he got there, he realized that he could establish enormous power for himself through advocating for sectionalism, through nullification, and through inventing this talking filibuster and pioneering it in the Senate today.
Nullification is important to understand. This is like the 1840s, I think, early 1840s, and this is an issue of nullification. John Calhoun, and we're going to talk about how he sort of institutes this minority rule idea. The nullification meant that he was pushing that states had the authority to be able to declare any federal law unconstitutional.
Right. That's right. So what Calhoun was doing is what you see conservatives do today, which is to take the minority protections in the Constitution and then expand them far beyond where they were ever intended. So James Madison was the lead advocate for minority protections, and he was the one chiefly trying to strike this balance we were talking about before. We're saying minority rights should be protected, they should have a voice, but the majority should eventually be able to rule. Calhoun looked at Madison's system and said explicitly, I don't think that's enough power for the minority. He wrote a tract called A Disquisition on Government, Calhoun did, and in that he explicitly stated that he was seeking to establish a veto power for the minority over the majority. And he didn't think Madison's system had given the minority enough power. So he tried to take Madison, and there was a brief period where Madison was still alive in the early 1830s, and Calhoun was starting to introduce these ideas, and Madison was asked to respond to it, and he did so in several letters, and he made very clear that Calhoun was taking his ideas far beyond what he intended. And then, unfortunately, he passed away as Calhoun continued to apply his ideas in the 1840s and into the 1850s. So, but yes, it's this idea that the minority should be able to override what the federal government wants to do. And, you know, fast forward today, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but that's essentially what you see in the Senate today. And in Calhoun's time, all he could do was forge this talking filibuster and give the minority the power to delay. It wasn't until later that the minority acquired the power to actually block and stop anything the federal government wants to do. But that is the Senate that we have today. So you can see a direct line between Calhoun's vision in the 1830s and 40s to what Mitch McConnell is doing today in the United States Senate, where the minority is able to stop anything that it wants to.
And Calhoun wanted this nullification authority with the creation and to be able to object to the creation of the Second National Bank. This would be an early precursor to, say, like the Federal Reserve. Why did he oppose that?
That's right. This was one of the first filibusters in recorded history, and arguably the first one because it sort of had all the characteristics that you would associate with the filibuster today. So this was 1841. This was Calhoun versus Clay. Clay was trying to advance this second bank bill. And this was a period where there are a lot of issues that weren't explicitly about slavery, but they really were about slavery. Territorial disputes and economic disputes were a big part of it, because there was a competition between which economic model was going to prove superior at the time, the Southern plantation-based export economy, or the Northern industrial emergent sort of capital-based economy. And the North sort of had the upper hand, and the existence of a bank, a national bank, was seen as a way to sort of further the North's advantage in this economic competition. And the South very explicitly at the time saw this as an issue of slavery. They saw the rise of the North's economic model and the sort of tilt of the nation towards that model overall as a tilt of power towards the North that would eventually lead to the abolition of slavery. So, they very clearly saw that as the stakes here. And so that is what led Calhoun to wage one of the first filibusters that we've seen, and arguably the first sort of modern talking filibuster in American history.
And a point of irony that you point out in your book is that a decade or so later, Calhoun, who's sticking up for minority rights here, is actually gagging and leading the charge to gag abolitionists from even being able to talk about the abolition of slavery in the Senate.
That's right. Yes, Calhoun wrapped his obstruction in these very lofty principles and saying he was defending free speech and minority rights, but he accused those who tried to cut off his filibuster of trying to institute a gag rule. But then a few years later, he advocated for explicitly a gag rule. This was a rule to prevent Congress from hearing abolitionist petitions that were being brought to them by the states outside. Specifically, this one was about the District of Columbia wanted to petition Congress to say abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. So Calhoun's advocacy for minority rights and free speech were very selective. This is one of the things that led the American historian Richard Hofstadter to label Calhoun the marks of the master class. He would stand up for the rights of the vulnerable only when it was the powerful and the overdog who was being threatened.
And throughout the rest, and this will be my last question about the 19th century, and I promise we'll get to the 20th. For the rest of the 19th century, there were attempts to try to undo what Calhoun had done and create this filibuster. And you write about it in your book, Kill Switch, about what lengths the minority, and I guess when we're talking about the minority, we're mostly talking about Southern lawmakers here. Maybe it's the Democrats at the time. I'll let you clarify. But at the length of what the minority did to defeat those efforts, even though it appeared they had the votes to kill a filibuster.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And the party system, the two-party system we know today, was still emerging at the time. So this was the period of the Whigs and the emergent Republican Party. So the party lines were still very fuzzy. Jackson, of course, sort of signaled the emergence of the Democratic Party that would come to stay. But it doesn't break down along party lines the way we think of today. It is much more along regional lines, as you said. It was the Southerners versus the Northerners primarily. And the Westerners were sort of an X factor in some of these debates. But yes, it was, the ability of the minority to sort of consistently outmaneuver those who wanted to implement reform as the filibuster was being introduced. And this is an important point because, like we were talking about earlier, we think of the filibuster as this part of Senate tradition, but when it was coming into existence, many senators were horrified at it and thought it was very damaging to the institution. It's hard to think of today, but the ethic that prevailed at the time was one of thoughtful consideration, but respect for their other colleagues' time, and obstruction was considered beneath the dignity of senators. And so, we think of reform sometimes as maybe an idea of the radical left and stuff like that, but it was actually the centrists who historically have been in favor of reform. Henry Clay, the great compromiser, senator from Kentucky, was the very first to try to do what we would today describe as going nuclear. We've acquired these hyperbolic terms. But in this 1841 filibuster over the bank bill, when Calhoun started to use this new tool, Clay thought this was very damaging to the institution. He thought this was obstructive. It was clear that Calhoun was not trying to improve the bill, only to block it. And so he moved to try to restore the ability of the majority to cut off debate, which was actually a rule the Senate originally had, but got lost sort of in translation in previous decades. But Calhoun was able to use the filibuster, as was started to become a pattern, to sort of maneuver Clay into having to choose between his immediate priority of the bank bill and the more abstract goal of reform. He basically ran out the clock on Clay. And Clay, as many people have done since then, chose his immediate priority. This was his top legislative priority, this bank bill. He chose to pass that over the goal of reform. And that's something we've seen a lot throughout history.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation about the history of the filibuster. Our guest is Adam Gentleson. He's executive director of Battleborn Collective, which is a legislative strategy organization, and also a former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid. He is the author of the book Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Adam Gentleson, I want to talk more about the relationship of the filibuster to efforts to address racism in this country and Jim Crow and these things. And one of these times where we see the Republicans go all out to try, I say Republicans, forgive me, when we've seen the Southern lawmakers go all out to try to stop from undoing the filibuster is in 1891. This is when Henry Cabot Lodge. I guess he's a Republican at the time.
That's right. It's still the party of Lincoln then. Yeah.
Still the party of Henry Cabot Lodge, who had become sort of a giant of the Senate, brings a measure to do away with the poll tax. What happens
there?
That's
right. Yeah, and so it's interesting that the party lines were so different then. It was actually Republicans who were far more aggressive about advocating for equality, for integration, for rights for African Americans. And that continued, up until the 1960s. It's a different story, but we think of Democrats as being the party of civil rights, but that didn't happen until much later. In fact, Democrats were the party of Southern segregationists and white supremacists, avowedly so. And so in 1891, you had two pillars of the Republican elite Northeastern establishment. They still were the party of sort of big banks and financial interest as well. Henry Cabot Lodge, as you said, and also Nelson Aldrich, senator from Rhode Island, who would go on to create the Federal Reserve. His daughter would marry a Rockefeller. You know, he was not a radical. He was a very establishment figure. And they had a bill, Cabot Lodge had a bill to eliminate poll taxes in the South in 1891. And, this was after Reconstruction had ended and the South had sort of fallen back under white supremacist rule, and Jim Crow was in full swing by this time. And so the Republican Party was trying to eliminate poll taxes. And this would have had a massive effect because the Black populations in Southern states at this time were upwards of 50% in places like Mississippi, over a third in places like Alabama and the Carolinas. So if those huge populations had been able to vote, even a fraction of those populations starting in the 1890s, the entire face of Southern leadership through the Jim Crow era would probably have looked different.
And we saw it look different, didn't we? Right after Reconstruction, or at the beginning
of
Reconstruction.
Exactly. That's right. It did look different when Blacks were given the right to vote and it was enforced during Reconstruction. So all of the horrible racist Southern leaders you think of during this era, all the way up to George Wallace of Alabama in the 60s, if these elected leaders had to be responsive to the Black people in their states who were made up huge populations, their leadership would have been very different. And you can sort of work backwards from there to think about how American history would have been different. But in 1891, there was a bill to eliminate poll taxes. It had clear majority support. The only thing stopping it was an extended filibuster. Again, sort of coordinating to maneuver their opponents into having to give up on it. And so the bill to eliminate poll taxes was Henry Cabot Lodge, and Nelson Aldrich rose in frustration and said, I'm tired of this filibuster and I'm going to move to do what Henry Clay had tried to do and give the majority the ability to cut off that debate, cut off that filibuster and go past the bill. And he seemed to be successful. The bill, there was test votes that showed that the bill itself had majority support, and that also Aldrich's move to sort of go nuclear, as we would call it today, also had majority support. But in one of these circumstances, the opponents were able to outmaneuver them. They literally found out that Aldrich's side had let a few of their members leave for the weekend and leave town. And so Aldrich's opponents were able to call up a vote when they knew that Aldrich didn't have the numbers because his members had left town. They literally brought members from their sick beds, carried them into the chamber to make sure that their side had the votes, and they were able to scuttle both the move to reform the filibuster and the bill to end poll taxes. Then the clock runs out on that session, and the rest is history. So, you know, the history of reform is a history of moderate senators trying to stop this slide into gridlock by the Senate and just being outmaneuvered in a few key instances, where they did seem to have a majority of the Senate in support of their efforts.
So someone needs to write a book about the history of carrying senators and representatives into the chamber for a very important
vote. Well, it's a chamber that tends to have some older members, so it happens not infrequently.
It is interesting to think about the evolution of the filibuster. I mean, we were talking about 1841. It wasn't, you know, it was a big deal, obviously, at the time. But I'm sure they didn't even imagine how this procedure would have been used, 180 years later.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, just to sort of have perspective, I mean, what Clay was horrified by was Calhoun, you know, delaying a bill for a few weeks. You know, and that caused him to reach for a very significant reform. So if Clay saw what happens today, where the minority is actually able to stop bills from passing whenever it wants to, he would be horrified 100 times over for certain.
Henry Cabot Lodge plays a big role in this story. We talked about what he did in 1891 in trying to bring to eliminate the poll tax. In 1922. He tried to bring an anti-lynching law. And that's where maybe we really do start to see, you'll disagree with me if you will, but my sense is that's when we really start to see a filibuster that we might recognize today.
That's right. This is the period, this Jim Crow era is the period where this supermajority threshold starts to emerge. And so just to be really clear about this, you know, all the way up into the early 20th century, every bill in the Senate passed or failed on the basis of whether it could secure a majority. It wasn't, and this idea of needing 60 votes or more than a 50% was totally alien and not a part of the original Senate. That didn't start happening until the Jim Crow era. What happened was that there was a big filibuster that caused a massive public backlash in 1917, where a group of isolationist senators blocked President Wilson's bill to arm American merchant ships leading up to the entry into World War I. This sparked massive backlash. Senators were literally being burned in effigy across the country. So the Senate came back quickly and it gave itself a rule called Rule 22 that allowed it to end a filibuster when it wanted to. Initially, they thought of setting that threshold for ending a filibuster at a majority. They couldn't quite get consensus around that in the committee that was making the rule. So they set it at a two-thirds majority on the thought that when a filibuster had clearly become obstructionist, there would always be a reasonable group of senators, a supermajority, who would come together and say, we may disagree on the merits of the bill, but we can all agree that this has gone on long enough. It's time to wrap up this debate and move to a majority vote. This was a time when the idea of majority rule still held very strong as an ethic in the Senate. So then what happens is that civil rights bills start to pass the House of Representatives, come over to the Senate, where they appeared to have majority support, and they had presidents of both parties ready to sign them. We talked about the 1891 anti-poll tax bill. In 1922, you had an anti-lynching bill that passed the House and came over to the Senate. The only thing that Southerners could do to stop these bills was to figure out a way to repurpose this supermajority threshold to force civil rights bills to have to clear a higher threshold than all other bills. And that's what they started to do. They would do the talking filibuster, and they would say to the majority, if you want to cut us off, you better use that supermajority threshold, because otherwise we're not yielding. This took a lot of effort, and they only applied it to civil rights. And so from this Jim Crow era, from the end of Reconstruction to 1964, the only bills that were stopped and killed altogether by the use of this supermajority threshold were civil rights bills. These were bills to end lynching, to end poll taxes, and even to end workplace discrimination that started passing the House with some frequency during this period, arriving in the Senate and being blocked only by the Senate filibuster. One thing I want to note is that sometimes we think that maybe America wasn't ready for civil rights until the 1950s and 60s, and that's just not true. You know, the House was passing these bills, presidents were willing to sign them, a majority of senators were behind them. This demonstrates, you know, these people have a finger on the pulse of their public, you know, that's representative of their position. But there was also some polling at the time. Gallup had just emerged as a polling organization, when they polled the issue of federal anti-lynching laws in 1937, they found 72% of the American public in support of anti-lynching laws. When they polled anti-poll tax laws in the 1940s, they found upwards of 60% of Americans in support of anti-poll tax laws. So America was ready to start passing civil rights bills decades before we actually did so. And the only thing that stopped it was the application of this new supermajority threshold to civil rights. I just want to make one more point on this, which is that, you know, this is the period where we built post-war America. And it's very important to remember that all the other bills, for the most part, that built post-war America did not face a supermajority threshold. They were able to pass or fail on a majority vote basis. Only civil rights was forced to clear this higher threshold. And part of the reason we have gridlock today is that we've now started to apply that higher threshold to all other issues.
Not even the New Deal programs or bills were blocked by a filibuster.
That's right. You know, the threat of the filibuster hung over a lot of them. And that was how Southerners caused Black and Brown Americans to be cut out of some important New Deal programs. Social Security excluded certain classes of employment that were predominantly African American. The GI Bill was the benefits were denied to African Americans. Federal home loans were denied. A lot of that was causing their implementation to be done at the local level, where in the South, the local officials implementing these programs could selectively deny their benefits to African Americans, and that was what Southerners intended. So, you know, they caused these programs to be racist in their application to a certain extent, but they didn't filibuster them. They never faced the filibuster. Medicare, which we think of as one of the great achievements of the Great Society period, did not face a filibuster. There's a memo from LBJ's top legislative aide, Mike Manatos, to LBJ saying he was thrilled to report that Medicare was going to pass because he could count a majority in the Senate in favor of Medicare. Once it was clear it was going to pass, a bunch more senators jumped on board and eventually 70 voted for it, but it never had to clear a supermajority threshold. It only had to clear a majority to pass.
This 40-year or so period of time between, I guess, the 1920s to the 1960s, in which basically only civil rights legislation was being filibustered, it's still the talking filibuster. You still had to physically hold the Senate floor. And we'll talk in a moment how that has changed. But I mean, were they just so, the 1957 bill eventually passed, but maybe they had the votes to break it. Same with the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Was it just, this was the one issue did they physically hold the floor the whole time? And were they set out to hold the floor indefinitely?
Yeah, this civil rights was the one issue that provided the motivation to do this very exhaustive process. No other issue provided that much motivation. But I mean, Southerners at the time, I mean, you go back and read their quotes, they're horrifying. They were very explicit that maintaining white supremacy was their primary goal in public service. I'm not using that term lightly. Richard Russell, the senator from Georgia, who's sort of the leader of the Southern bloc at this time, said, his exact words were, any Southern man worth a pinch of salt would give his all to maintain white supremacy. So not throwing this term around, it's what they declared themselves to be. And they operated as a bloc. They were very powerful. They controlled Southerners, that was. They controlled most of the powerful committees in the Senate. So they were able to coordinate as a bloc to do these extended talking filibusters. They were able to constantly wield the threat of it. And so, you know, it quickly became clear to advocates of civil rights that if they were going to bring a civil rights bill to the floor, they were going to face a coordinated filibuster from this powerful Southern bloc. It's also important to note that the idea of majority leaders didn't exist at this time. The role itself wasn't even created until the 1920s. And even then it was sort of a clerical role. So these Southerners were the leaders of the Senate and they wielded an enormous power. And when they said they were going to block a bill and they would filibuster it if you brought it to the floor, you were not making a good career move as a senator to try to cross them. But yes, it was the only category of legislation that ever faced that kind of opposition all the way up through the 1960s. And the 1957 bill that you mentioned, it did pass without breaking a filibuster, but that's because Southerners gutted it and made it so toothless that they found it acceptable.
It was basically a commission. Exactly.
They filibustered over, or they threatened to filibuster it over the summer of 1957 until it was completely removed of all of its teeth. And then they dropped their filibuster and said, this will pass. And the theory at the time was that it would provide a steam valve and there wouldn't be any more civil rights bills after that. That obviously proved a miscalculation on their part, but they let that one pass.
Interesting point about Richard Russell, the Senate Senator segregationist you were mentioning, that one of the Senate office buildings is named after him.
Well, it just goes to show how deeply ingrained, you know, these white supremacist influence in our governing structures are, that people didn't really think much about naming an office building after him in 1971. You know, this isn't ancient history, but he was still considered a sort of, you know, leading institutionalist and defender of the Senate. And yes, there are thousands of people who go to work every day right now in an office building named after a man who declared that his primary purpose in public service was the preservation of white supremacy.
Yeah, as we see the Black Lives Matter movement, and we see what the protests of last summer and the Confederate statues coming down, I thought about both the Russell Building and also the John C. Calhoun portrait that hangs just outside the Senate chamber, but both still in place. In the 1970s, we get a really significant rule change to the filibuster that makes the filibuster, I would think, even more potent today, even than it was in this history that we're talking about. And that was creating what, is it correct to call it a stealth filibuster? This is, it's a rule change in which instead of actually physically having to hold the floor, you can just indicate that you want to hold the floor, or that you're going to enact a filibuster, and then they just make it a procedural move. And if you have the 60 votes to break it, then you break it. If not, you never get to that piece of legislation.
Yes, that's right. And so, you know, you talk about unintended consequences. The motivation behind that rule change was that the leaders of the Senate, the party leaders, so by this time, you know, majority leader had become a thing. You know, that position was created in the 1920s, didn't really have any power until LBJ breathed power into it when he took over in the 1950s. And so by the 1970s, the leaders were sort of the recognized generals of the floor who would just determine what came to the floor when. And it was a really hard job. And the size of the federal government was growing rapidly at this time. They were creating new departments like the EPA. There was more work for the Senate to do, more appropriations bills to pass, more oversight to conduct. And the job of managing the floor got to be a lot harder. And so as a leader, you didn't want to bring a bill to the floor and have it run into a filibuster and possibly get stuck there for weeks or maybe months on end and scuttle all the other business that you needed to conduct. So basically, as a management efficiency step, they started saying, we're going to canvass the caucus ahead of time and basically put out an APB and say, is anybody planning to filibuster a bill? And you write back to us and tell us if you are. And if you say that you are, then we know that we probably won't bring that bill to the floor. Or if we do, we know we have to get that supermajority threshold in order to advance the bill and cut off debate and end your filibuster. So it became routine for senators to just sort of signal to the majority leader, I intend to filibuster. And that sort of, in effect, saddled that individual bill with the higher threshold of a supermajority votes. It's important to be clear, though, that this was still used very rarely through the 70s and 80s. We're talking a handful of times per year. It wasn't until the 2000s, then in particular, Mitch McConnell's rise to power as minority leader, that this became used against everything that came before the Senate. But it was this ease of use that started to happen in the 1970s, where you didn't have to go to the floor to give a speech. You could just tell the majority leader you intended to filibuster. It was that ease of use that set up the filibuster to be deployed on a mass scale by Mitch McConnell under President Obama.
I was a Capitol Hill correspondent during the George W. Bush years. And a few things. I do remember the filibuster being used. I remember Democrats used it to stop, at the time, drilling in the Arctic in Anwar. And I remember Republicans using it as well. I remember Democrats using it in the Senate to block some of George W. Bush's controversial picks to the judiciary. And this is the first time I think we start hearing of this quote unquote nuclear option. And they actually made Democrats hold the floor for, I think, like 24 hours. They brought cots. I mean, it seemed like a circus at the time, right?
Right.
It seemed like it was more just a show. They brought cots into the chamber where senators could take naps and these kind of things. And at the time, I was sitting there thinking, like, okay, this is just sort of a dog and pony show. I did not know what was going to happen, say, 15 years later and be where we are now. Just the escalation in the fight and the use of the filibuster. But Democrats have used it as well. And then it is, maybe you were with Harry Reid during this time, when Harry Reid was a Senate Majority Leader, because Republicans now were blocking Obama's judicial picks. Harry Reid changes the filibuster rule to where you can't use a filibuster towards lower court nominees. You could still use it for Supreme Court, but not lower court. Well, inevitably, that led to Mitch McConnell doing away with the filibuster for the Supreme Court nominees. And now we have a 6-3 majority in the Supreme Court that, unless something happens, probably isn't going to change anytime quickly. Was changing the filibuster rules over this past decade, in the end, detrimental to Democrats?
I don't think it was, because what happened when we changed the rules in 2013, and I was with Reid at the time, Obama was facing a historic amount of Republican obstruction, and he was on track to have the fewest judicial nominees confirmed of any president since Ronald Reagan. And if we hadn't changed the rules, he would have left office with the fewest judicial nominees confirmed of any president since Reagan. Once we changed the rules, we were able to push through a wave of Obama justices who are now serving lifetime appointments on the federal bench. So those people would not be on the bench today if we hadn't changed the rules then. As you said, McConnell then came into power and then used that lower threshold to confirm many nominees himself. I happen to think, based on watching Senator McConnell closely for many years, and I think even a casual observer of how he has conducted himself would maybe also come to this conclusion, which is that if we had left the filibuster in place and Democrats had been able to use it against McConnell's judicial nominees in 2017, the first time Democrats led a filibuster against a nominee that McConnell really wanted to confirm, McConnell would have just gotten rid of the filibuster himself and gone on to confirm all of the nominees that he did confirm in real life. In addition, he would have had more vacancies to fill because we hadn't gotten rid of the filibuster ourselves and filled them with Obama justices. So I have a hard time believing that when Democrats, if the filibuster was still in place and Democrats filibustered judicial nominees in 2017, we all know how important judicial nominees have been to Senator McConnell. I have a hard time believing that McConnell would have just let Dems filibuster and thrown up his hands and say, well, there's nothing I can do. You know, he could have gotten rid of it himself. And I think that's probably what he would have done. So, and then I think there's a structural question here, which is that you're absolutely right that Democrats have used it themselves. Although even during that period, I'd point out that Democrats still, the ethic of majority rule still did prevail to a large extent against Samuel Alito, Bush's Supreme Court nominee. Democrats could have filibustered him, and they did for a little while, but then they dropped it. Alito was confirmed with 58 votes, so he didn't even clear the 60 votes needed to clear a filibuster, but Democrats decided to drop their filibuster there. So, you know, there was still the idea that everything absolutely needs 60 still hadn't fully taken hold. But I would also say there's a structural issue here, which is that, you know, in our political system, you have the conservative side and the liberal side, and the progressive liberal side wants to enact change, and the conservative side wants to maintain the status quo. Obviously, there's some exceptions to that, but fundamentally, this is a true statement about the dynamic. This the famous William F. Buckley quote that conservatives are the party that stand athwart history yelling stop. So a tool that makes it harder to pass legislation inherently benefits conservatives far more than progressives. The biggest tool in progressives' toolbox is passing legislation, like in the Great Society, in the New Deal. You know, that's what we need to make change. There's really no other way to do change on the same scale. You can't do it through executive actions. You can't do it through reconciliation. Nothing compares to the ability to pass legislation. Conservatives can roll back regulations through executive branch actions, through the judiciary. They can get tax cuts through reconciliation, some of these workarounds. They can get most of their agenda passed just by preserving the status quo and passing some of these rollbacks. Progressives can't. So this tool automatically benefits conservatives more than Democrats. And there have been studies that show that the filibuster is used, one study showed twice as often by conservatives than by progressives. So there is a bit of tit for tat. There is some use by both sides. But if you step back and look at the big picture, it overwhelmingly benefits conservatives more than progressives. And just look at Biden's agenda right now. With the filibuster remains in place, huge agenda items of President Biden's are never going to pass, including things like voting rights that are required to fix our democracy as it sort of starts to slide in a dangerous direction that some experts have called, you know, the direction of soft authoritarianism. These things are going to fail, unless we reform the filibuster.
It's all coming to a head. H.R. 1, yes. This labor bill that was just approved the House of Representatives, and a host of other things. The Equality Act. I mean, we can go on and on about the things that have passed the House of Representatives that don't look like they can survive a filibuster in the Senate. Adam, I think you make a compelling argument for abolishing the filibuster, and the history that you lay out about the filibuster in your book, Killswitch, is fantastic. But I do wonder, for people who are calling for to end the filibuster now, would they have supported it if Mitch McConnell would have done it while Donald Trump was president? I mean, couldn't things have been worse than they already were?
Well, Democrats didn't make much use of the filibuster. I have a couple answers to this, but you know, under Donald Trump, the filibuster was not a huge advantage for Democrats. Republicans, when they tried to repeal Obamacare, the filibuster was not what Democrats used to stop it, because Republicans tried to repeal Obamacare through reconciliation, which means they only needed a majority to do it, and they couldn't even get a majority to do it. And that's another sort of telling point, which is that, you know, progressive reforms and progressive benefits, once they're in place, are very difficult to undo, even in our polarized age. You know, Obamacare wasn't popular until Republicans tried to repeal it. And once they tried to take it away, people realized they really liked it. So, you know, even an issue that at the time was polling at like 35-40%, even in our polarized environment, Republicans weren't able to muster a majority to repeal it. I think that's a telling point. Progressive benefits are things people like, and they tend to be one-way ratchets. But once they're in place, they're really hard to undo. The other thing I would say is that the use of the filibuster has become essentially a tool of minority rule. And we are a diverse country, and the filibuster enables a minority of predominantly white, overwhelmingly male senators to wield veto power over the overall agenda of our country. I think that's a dangerous dynamic for a democracy, when the agenda of the federal government starts to diverge so profoundly from the interests of its people. I don't think that's a healthy dynamic. And I think, you know, if Republicans come back to power, they will probably use the filibuster, the fact that it's gotten rid of, to pass things that Democrats don't like. But if we don't get rid of it, we're not going to make any of the changes that are needed to reform income inequality, to reform voting rights, to address climate change. All of these things are certainly going to die by the filibuster. And I think we'll find ourselves in an even more difficult situation. And of course, McConnell can always get rid of it himself. So we will forego all of these priorities, and then maybe we'll find ourselves wishing we'd just passed them, because McConnell, when he has something he wants to pass, will just get rid of it with a flick of the wrist.
Final question. You may have just sort of addressed this in what you just said, but I mean, there does seem to be an argument that maybe in order to change the laws that everyone's going to be governed by, you should have a minority of the minority to support it. You know, maybe 10 of the 45, 48, 50 senators who represent the minority at the time, just to give a law change a sense of legitimacy. And that if you also have that minority of a minority that will vote for a law and break a filibuster, it's also going to be much harder if you have a regime change, an administration change, to undo that law. Where if you maybe take away the filibuster, we can enact these major programs now, but perhaps 4 years from now, they're being undone. And could that create a sense of political instability that really would even hurt our programs that, you know, and eventually have a deleterious effect on people who use or benefit from these programs?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a real danger that is often raised in these discussions. I think the example of Obamacare repeal is instructive there, where Republicans, you know, this was the thing they ran on for 7 years. It was their number one campaign issue, and they were unable to repeal Obamacare, even though they only needed a majority to do it. So I think it's hard to repeal things. And I think that we're unlikely to see this whiplash where one side passes things, the other side comes in and unpasses it or repeals it. So I think that's, you know, historical examples have shown that's less likely. I also think that, you know, getting some amount of buy-in from the minority is important and would be good, But in some ways, the filibuster prevents that from happening. Right now, you know, 60 is a relatively arbitrary threshold. And the idea of getting 10 Republicans to cross over with Democrats right now is almost laughable. However, the idea of getting maybe 3 or 5 Republicans, Lisa Murkowski, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, to cross over is much more likely. And, you know, you could conceive of a situation where Democrats pass a big important bill with maybe 53, 54, 55 votes. That would be a major bipartisan accomplishment, but you're never going to get to 60. And so under the current circumstances with the filibuster, because you failed to get to 60, even though you have 5 Republicans on board, the bill won't pass. And so in that way, the filibuster stifles bipartisanship and makes it harder to achieve. And it's really just become a tool for the minority to block and manufacture gridlock whenever they want. So I think that, you know, if you are looking for bipartisanship, the way to create positive conditions is to have things pass again and to have legislators start becoming legislators again. And the gears of the Senate will start turning. And I think those are the conditions in which you're more likely to see at least a small number of Republicans occasionally cross over, rather than giving them the ability to block everything by uniting as a minority against it.
Adam Gentleson has been our guest. Adam Gentleson, executive director of Battleborne Collective. He's a former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid, and he's the author of the book Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Adam Gentleson, I found that very informative, and I do thank you very much for taking this time.
It was a great conversation. I love being here. Thank you.